Making Media tells the story of our media business, Colossus. If you aren't familiar with our platform, make sure to check out joincolossus.com. There you'll find our latest episodes across each of our shows, the transcripts, supporting third-party materials, and even some written content as well. So whether you're an investor or an operator, we're out to create the content that we wish we had when we were in those exact roles. Invest Like the Best, Business Breakdowns, Web3 Breakdowns, and Founders each cover different angles of the ecosystem. And our special series like 50X and Return on India are targeting niche topics. Again, make sure to check out joincolossus.com for more on the platform.
Let's do this.
Welcome to Making Media.
Humans are in an eternal quest for convenience. Save me time, make my life easier.
Gosh, that was such a good start to an interview.
Welcome back to Making Media. Our guest today is a sports media veteran, Mike Strickhoff. Mike spent a decade producing live sports talk on national TV, first working at MLBN before moving to Fox Sports, where he helped launch Undisputed. Mike worked on that show alongside Skip Bayless, Shannon Sharp, and others as the mainline producer. In 2017, he left national TV for tech, going to work at Snap, where he led their sports and gaming content. More recently, he's launched his own business, connecting investors and content producers, and he also works as an advisor to many digital media companies. Matt and I tap into all of his experience in a fascinating discussion that centers around personality-driven media businesses and how that's evolved, both at the national scale and also at the independent creator level. Please enjoy this discussion with Mike and stick around at the end for our debrief.
All right, Mike, excited to have you here and really cover your entire career, because I think you've been at such interesting places. There's some themes that will certainly tie together and we'll get into those. I wanted to start with what is something that stands out on the resume. You were there for the launch of Undisputed, and I just need to know what it was like going into that and maybe just the biggest surprises that came about from that launch of that show that really dominates so much of the media world for good and bad. Talk us through the lessons and surprises from launching Undisputed.
It was a really amazing time. So my background, I started in TV production, sort of working my way up the ladder of various kinds of studio programming. I did that at Major League Baseball. And then I went over and was there at the beginning of FS1. I got so much cool experience building out all of these different talk shows that they have. And they asked me to be the line producer for Undisputed before it was launched. And I was really fortunate to work with a Jamie Horowitz type person who is like a legendary figure in our industry, like created First Take, found Skip Bayless, all of these different things. And the rest of that team that was putting Undisputed together with Skip, they gave me like such an amazing opportunity to have an impact on that show. And so I was in the chair, line producing the first ever episode of Undisputed, and it was such a thrill. I think the thing that I was so intrigued by when I first really got to see how they do it, because a lot of it is a lot of the lessons from First Take sort of like poured it over to Fox. And keep in mind, this is like 8 years ago when I did this. Now it's amazing to think that show has been on for 8 years now, but the show is optimized to leverage the talent that they pick. That is everything. So everything that the producers and the executives are thinking about when it comes to Undisputed or First Take or any of these talk shows is, we have this great talent. How do we get the most out of them? And what you see today, or what you saw like when I was there for that year that I did that job, is a format and a look and a feel that was forged in the fires of years of learnings at ESPN, as famously that segment on Cold Pizza with Skip evolved into First Take and then into Undisputed and all of FS1's programming now and beyond. That whole thing is about optimizing the talent that you have. And it's a really smart thing. We'll talk about this a little bit more, I imagine, but they have so much time in these segments to talk. It feels a little bit like a talk radio show on television in many respects that really allows the talent to like be freed up to say everything that they want to say, to like be their true selves. Once I like sort of got under the hood and really like understood how it worked, I was like, oh, yeah, why wouldn't we want these like amazingly funny people and smart people like Skip and like Shannon Sharp to like have this freedom to express themselves in this way that's super entertaining? That was like the main thing. And then the other thing that I took away from that whole experience, the whole experience of making daily sports content, is that it is the funnest grind that you can imagine. You wake up every day and you have a blank rundown and you have to fill that thing out every single day. I used to tell people what I do and they're like, no way, that's like the coolest job ever. And it is. It's a really fun job being in the control room, thinking about, is LeBron the GOAT all day? It's kind of like my job. That is a super fun job, doing it every single day. It's like this relentless flow of creativity that you have to have every single day. And I like have so much respect for like what Stephen A., Skip, Shannon, all of the guys in that space do to summon the energy to do what they do every single day, 5 days a week.
We talk about that a lot as well. Both sides of it. A, people who have podcasts that run for 3 or 4 hours, that is no joke in itself. And then the challenge of, you know, if you have a lights out week and you feel really good about yourself on Friday evening, show up on Monday morning and you've got to do it all again and you start from zero. I want to go back a little bit, though. We'll talk about those things in a bit more detail later, to the point you made about your job was allowing the personalities to flourish. And you talked about how time helped in that. What were some of the other kind of nuts and bolts ways that you were allowing Skip and the rest of the people in front of the camera to kind of bring themselves out and allow the show to grow?
A lot of what makes them really thrive, like those types of people, is putting them in positions to talk about the things they want to talk about. Nothing else really matters, but if we could get Skip and Shannon talking about a thing that gets them both really animated and really passionate about in an organic way, they were going to be comfortable on camera. Especially Skip, who has so much experience doing this kind of format. Skip doesn't need coaching, certainly not from someone like me. It's certainly not 8 years ago, like a relatively young producer. So I think a lot of the way that that show is put together is built around hitting the things that are like, again, bespoke to the talent. If a certain person in your show is not really very interested in topic X or sport X or something like that, you won't hear about it very much on the show because it would feel inorganic and the talent would be sort of uncomfortable being very opinionated or summoning that energy we were just talking about in an inorganic way. Everything you see on these shows is very much organic. They feel the way that they feel off camera and on camera. There's not like this new energy once they get in front of the camera. Shannon Sharp is so dynamic and funny off camera, exactly how you might think. I used to sit next to him in meetings every morning at 4 a.m. because Undisputed is a very early Pacific time show. And he would come in at 4 a.m. with just like all the energy and all the charisma that you see on camera. And I was like, how are you doing this? I've been up drinking coffee for hours, putting this rundown together, and I don't have nearly this much energy.
Built different. They are a different breed, many of them. I've heard similar anecdotes about Stephen A. in terms of the energy that he can bring doing it that many hours a day. When you think about taking what they're interested in and then also making sure that it's going to be topics that the audience is interested in the case like Skip, the audience is generally interested in LeBron, the Cowboys, things like that. Did you ever have to battle with, oh, this person is interested in only in topics that might not play to the audience? Does it seem to be that there's a correlation between what's really popular and what those hosts or those personalities are interested in? Anything unique there?
Skip is so tuned into what works with the audience. I don't really remember any issues like that with him or with Shannon. Shannon actually was really interesting because he is a football guy who has since become this like much larger thing. And he really prided himself on being able to do anything. He loves talking basketball just as much as football. He's like a big LeBron guy. So those two guys in particular, like they were such pros and like so able to like really flex and do anything. It also just so happened that they were very interested in the things that people want to talk about. Now, there were other times at different points of my career where like you do have to like talk to a talent and help them see the importance about talking about thing X. I've definitely been in like disagreements with former professional athletes who are much bigger and stronger than me about like what we should be talking about. I remember a certain time where the talent on a show I was working on really wanted to do this deep dive into the economics of the draft. And I was like, hey, guys, that is a very cool thing. And your takes on it are super interesting. I'm not sure that our audience cares. And so sometimes you do have to do that. Sometimes you do have to step in and like look out for the audience. The good ones are also looking out for the audience. And the good ones also know what animates them is going to animate the audience, and what animates the audience is going to animate them.
Yeah, it definitely seems like, I mean, particularly with Skip, plays off of the audience and how animated they get. It's almost like they're very unified in some ways. Do you think that there's any other wide misconceptions about what goes on behind the scenes? You mentioned everything that's happening on the screen is organic and plays out that way. Do you think there's any misconceptions when you're talking to people and you have to convince them like, no, this is the case, or surprises that you would point to?
Yeah, I just like smirk because this is all I hear. You're putting it very diplomatically. You asked me at the top, like, what were my big surprises? One of the big surprises is to find that like none of that stuff is true. It's really not. You want to like pick the topics that are right for the audience and right for the talent. I think there's this idea that a topic is presented, and then in the case of Undisputed, like very hypothetically, Skip will take a side and Shannon will take a side, and they'll just like go off and like formulate arguments to debate in that way. But that's not how it works. First of all, that show was built with talent that see differently about big topics. It wouldn't be as fun if you put Skip with like just another Cowboys fan. It's fun to have Shannon, who is naturally inclined to not be a Cowboys fan, to be sort of the contrarian. That's natural for Shannon. The producers of that show were smart, in a sense, to like make sure that the talent is complementary in that way, and that it wouldn't just be like Skip says something for 5 minutes, the other guy says something for 5 minutes, and it's exactly the same. I think you want like some diversity of perspective on these shows. That's not to say like they're not apart on literally everything. Sometimes just like not an interesting conversation because they both kind of feel exactly the same way. And there were times where you just like say, okay, like we don't need to do this topic. I think if it was a topic that was massively important, and just like it would look really weird if that like wasn't in the A block. I don't know what it is, Deflategate or something. They'll just figure out a way to make that conversation interesting, but they're not going to like camp out on both sides and inorganically create this false debate narrative.
What do you think the optimal ratio of friction to kind of agreement is? There must be a sweet spot where people feel like they're getting enough spice, where they don't feel like antagonized the whole time by what's going on in front of them.
It's true. You definitely need some level of conflict, for lack of a better word, because it makes it more fun. It sort of reflects how like we all sit around and talk about sports with our buddies, depending on the topic that's happening around the bar or whatever. You can't have that all the time. There is a moment for, you need some substance. But I think also conversely, if there's too much substance and too much like X's and O's, and it's not fun. So it's like you use the conflict and the entertainment value and the comedy to like sort of deliver substance. Once you're very invested in the conversation about what Skip thinks about the Cowboys and you're there, then you can learn. Skip has been following the Cowboys for a very long time and knows a lot about football and the Cowboys. So there are things that you can learn from him when you listen to him, and sort of the conflict and the like entertainment value of it all is sort of like the top of the funnel.
And how do you test for that compatibility ahead of time? You've done the research, their viewpoints, and then do you sit them together and watch them converse and see whether there is a fit and there's chemistry that would work on air, or is there a different process?
A lot of the times these guys already sort of know each other. Shannon did a quick stint on First Take after his time on CBS. And I think there was like a natural compatibility. People knew where Shannon was on a lot of these big topics. I wasn't in these meetings where like they first met or anything like that. I'm sure that was a Jamie level kind of thing. But yeah, you definitely want these guys to like get along. Because famously, obviously, that doesn't always happen. There can be conflict behind the scenes.
Point two, if they're getting up at 4 a.m. and having to talk to each other every day, they're like, you kind of need someone that you don't mind seeing at that time in the morning.
It's hard to keep that relationship with anyone. Yeah, it's been interesting to see with First Take, you had the departure last summer and it was almost like the tryout over the next few months and testing people out and the compatibility. So much goes into it because chemistry, it just feels like everything, whether you intentionally realize it as a viewer or it's subtle and behind the scenes. so important when there's chemistry between hosts, and when there's not, you could just feel it.
Yeah. I just want to add one more thing. That format and the way that it's structured, it's just such an amazing way to get the most out of talent. I wanted to make sure I got this in because I think it's fascinating to watch Shannon Sharpe's journey through media. Hall of Fame football player. He gets out, he goes and does CBS. Back then, there wasn't really a whole lot of other former player analyst jobs than being in the CBS morning show, the Fox morning show, or whatever. On that show, his time to talk and his time to sort of like give his opinion and his perspective is really small. They have a ton of commercials they're trying to run. There's like 9 other guys on the desk. And it's just a very hard thing for like someone to get their personality out in that short amount of time. Hat tip to Terry Bradshaw for figuring that out. Super hard to do. You just don't have a lot of time. So Shannon then goes to Undisputed and people are like, wait a minute, he has so much more personality. It really opened him up from his days at CBS to Undisputed. And people got to see his entire personality. People are making memes with his various faces on the internet and stuff. And he's become this incredibly interesting character, more so than like a former football player. And now obviously he's back on First Take a little bit and does his Club Shay Shay podcast, which is like massive. Think about that journey. That journey through media just like wasn't possible 30 years ago. There was nowhere for Shannon to go. If you look at it now, he's gone from that to being this leading personality in our media ecosystem.
Yeah. Curious, do you think that can extend outside of sports as well?
Oh, yeah. Oh, God, yeah. Especially in the podcast world. Like, I don't have to tell you guys, but there is talk about things people watch. I think about sports talk as essentially that for sports fans. My wife watches what I would consider to be like junk reality TV shows, but to her, it's absolutely not that. There are podcasts that are an hour long where they break down the episodes and kind of go blow by blow through the beats of the story. She's very invested in like characters X, Y, and Z for like various reasons. And then it all culminates at the end of the season with a big moment of some kind. This ability for talent to have this time to talk about things has gone everywhere. And yeah, like without the podcast world and the flexibility that the podcast medium seems to provide, I'm not sure that like a lot of that stuff would exist.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a place for nuance where it's increasingly not a place for nuance in other media forms, to your point. Whether it's on the pregame shows where you have 6 people who have to fit in to 15 seconds or any other place. Yeah, it's increasingly shrinking. I want to zoom out a bit on the FS1 launch, just your experience there as well as a contrast and just an interesting case study looking back on it. You had ESPN, who was this dominant player, and it felt like to go after their turf was going to be incredibly difficult. But it felt like there was a unique approach, at least from my perspective, where leaned into personalities a bit more, had felt like a West Coast vibe for whatever reason. And it might just be the shows that I tuned into. But just thinking about that and the FS1 experience, kind of lessons that you could take away from that, what would you point to more broadly than just Undisputed?
I totally get your thought about it being like a West Coast vibe. It certainly was, especially if you just go right into Fox Sports Live. The Andy Roddick, Donovan McNabb, that whole thing that they did. Carissa Thompson was like the host of that. That was very much West Coast vibes, very relaxed, very chill. Again, designed to like maximize the talent that they had. And I think in many ways, a lot of that stuff was ahead of its time. If you look at content now, it's almost more similar to that show. Some of the biggest sports properties out there, like a Pardon My Take, things like this. It's almost like the world has sort of gone in that direction. And they were just like the first ones to do it. And like nobody was fully ready. It also didn't help that they like tried to beat ESPN at the height of its powers. It was a super bold and aspirational move. And it was really fun to be there and try to help them build that. But yeah, obviously like ESPN back then, especially, had just such a stranglehold. I think it like at the end of the day, it may have just been too difficult to like radically change audience behavior. Especially like in that environment of 2013 or whenever I first got there, more than 10 years ago, which is kind of a scary thing to say out loud. I really liked it. It was really fun. For me, I worked a lot with talent. I worked a lot with those names I mentioned and others around the Fox FS1 empire. Being at that phase of my career, being able to like sit in the green room and watch a football game with Donovan McNabb was really fun. Watching an NBA game with Gary Payton was really, really fun. In baseball with Pete Rose, Frank Thomas, like all of those legendary dudes. It was so much fun. But back to your point, yeah, there also is a massive spirit of innovation at Fox generally. They're known for this. Going all the way back to when they got the NFL and they put in the first down line. That's the cliche, if you want to like talk about that. But I think they really went into this trying to do something different. They didn't want to just do exactly what ESPN did. They wanted to have their own perspective on it. So one of their first shows was Fox Football Daily. And the idea of that was, yeah, let's give Terry Bradshaw and these other guys a lot more time to talk. That show was awesome. If you like watch that show as a football fan, it was better. Like, in my opinion, I worked on it. It was better than anything else going at the time. So I don't know. I think FS1 did a lot of really cool things, varying levels of success there, and perhaps a little bit too far ahead of their time. But like, it's still going strong. People are still watching Undisputed and First Things First, Nick Wright and stuff. Those numbers seem to still be really good. Like, I think people sometimes think, oh, FS1 didn't destroy ESPN, therefore it was a failure. FS1 has been around for 11 years. That seems pretty successful to me.
Yeah, and it feels like they had quite a bit of an impact on ESPN as well. I mean, from the SportsCenter days of, it doesn't matter who your host is, you're just supposed to tune in and the host is almost kind of like in the background, to now, I think the case has been proven. People want to attach to certain personalities. And yeah, there's been a big model shift, which has been interesting.
I want to transition to your next move. So you were in national TV for a decade or so, and then you went to tech and Snap specifically to build out their sports content. Talk us through just the thesis that they laid out to you and why you thought that was a compelling opportunity to go and work there.
What a fascinating journey it's been, the way you just put it. When I was doing Undisputed, right, and I was in that control room every day, 5 days a week, I was so happy. The first phase of my career was building towards that chair. Once you get there and you sort of are doing that every day, that's the first major step in that career track up towards being an executive or hopefully something like that someday. So I was super happy and I was never looking around or anything, but I got hit up by a recruiter at this thing called Snap Inc., which back in 2017, like, I don't think anyone knew that they were incorporated under Snap yet. Probably had just happened. They weren't public yet when they reached out to me. So I was like, huh, what's this? And so I started looking around. And I've always been like very much interested in where the future of media is going. I went to FS1 to try to help them sort of build out the future of national sports talk. Snap to me represented an opportunity to like help build what a sports content platform could look like. It was so interesting and still is to think about the nature of the impact that a platform like Snap can have on an entire generation of people around the world. I looked at all those things and I said, I've got to go do this. I've got to go try to do this. Like, this is incredible.
And what was the strategic imperative from Snap? Because at the time, it was just like a photo sharing thing. You send someone something, they deleted, moved on. It was very much kind of peer-to-peer. The sports content and I guess just owned, operated content itself, both in and outside of sports. What was the thinking there from the business perspective that they were asking you to come and build out?
When I got there, they had launched Snap Discover a year or so before I had gotten there. And they were building that out. Some of it was like these publisher style, like magazine style pieces of content. I don't know if you remember that. It was really a reading experience primarily. And that's when they partnered with all of these huge media brands and all of that. Sometime, I forget the exact order of how all these things happened, but at one point they also launched a content product called Our Stories, which was essentially, they were getting a lot of snaps from people like at events, particularly sports games. And we had teams of people that would like compile those snaps that were like submitted publicly to Snapchat and tell a story with that video. Just using that footage to create a 3 to 5 minute piece of video that sort of like told the story of the game. So I was brought in to help sort of like amplify that project. My job was to like help figure out what events that we should cover, what sports we should cover, working with the leagues to like coordinate when we would partner directly with leagues on these things for access and for footage and for marks and other things like that. So Snap was getting serious into content. And yeah, you're right. Snapchat is primarily a chat app with a photo sharing element to it. And like, that's still true. The content platform is also massive. And I really got a sense of the differences there between a content first platform, like a YouTube or like a cable television versus a Snapchat, where people go to chat with their friends and keep their streak alive, maybe mess around with some AR and some filters. And then while they're waiting for a response, go watch some content. If you put yourself in that perspective, it totally changes the way that you make programming and editorial decisions. It was just like a fascinating first year that I had there, because I was like, I have to like rewire myself almost completely. We were just talking about Undisputed and Skip, and my editorial senses had been sort of tuned to like the Cowboys and all of that being the most important thing, because that was what the audience of that show was like really interested in. When I got to Snap, there was a moment where Tony Romo retired. That's how long ago this was. It was like first couple of months I was at Snap. And so my editorial senses go absolutely crazy. If I'm in the Undisputed talent room, everybody's going nuts because Tony Romo just retired and we can talk about his legacy. And it's a massive story for Undisputed. For Snap, it's not. It wasn't. I like produced a story and like got all that together and then like look at the numbers in real time, which is awesome. And I'm like, oh, it was kind of a real rude awakening for me that like, this is a completely different audience, different types of people, different viewing behaviors. And so, yeah, it was a really wild first few months for me to like sort of like totally rethink how I think about sports content.
What did work? If the Tony Romo piece doesn't work, what did work?
I know, hard to imagine that they wouldn't have cared about Tony Romo, a 37-year-old guy retiring, or however old he was when he retired.
Yeah, most probably don't realize that he had a career before broadcasting. That's the sad part.
Totally. I know. There were a lot of moments when I worked at Snap where I felt old. And I got to Snap when I was 29 or 30, and I still like felt old. You know what it is? The younger generation is definitely like more attuned to personality. We're just talking about all these personality things. And I think the sports that show that the best tend to like still resonate with younger audiences. Again, you're thinking about this from the perspective of someone who's sitting on their couch and is just like scrolling a feed of either Tiles or today a Spotlight feed, which is like a full screen vertical experience. And the intentional nature of the viewing is so different that people are not ready to sit there and listen to a 10-minute expose on the X's and O's of the defensive line. That's just not what people are there for. If people want to hear about like Jake Paul's Mike Tyson fight, yeah, they're going to be very much into that. It's so hot with personality and like fun. Back then, a lot of the leagues were still catching up to this idea. If you look at what the leagues do then versus now in this respect, it's just amazing the transformation that they've undergone. And to their credit, they didn't have to do that, but they like were wise to.
One of the big differences, it seems to my mind as well, is just the time you had. You're producing a 2-3 hour show, and now these clips are minutes at most long. How did you reorient yourself in that capacity to be able to deliver really good stuff, but in a much compressed time slot?
When you look at the analytics across any platform, not just Snap, because these platforms are so like frenetic, user attention spans are so much lower. This isn't like an old man take. It's just the nature of the way the platform is set up. It like encourages you to move through content. On TikTok, the swipe up is like so easy to do. The simplest and most natural move of your thumb, and you're in a completely different experience. And you can fly through hundreds of those, and many people do. So when you're in that sort of like ecosystem for content, you have to nail people in the first 2 seconds. We had like analytics back in the day, and I'm sure this is still true, that if you didn't do a good job selling people within the first second of content, that you would lose them. They would just swipe forward to the next thing or go answer a text in the message app on their phone. There's like a million things hitting people all the time. I did a case study at Snap once where I looked at literally the first still image of the episode or of the story. And if that first frame of the first shot was like an interesting, compelling frame, definitely better performance. It's not hyperbole to say you have a second or two at most to grab people's attention. That's why you see a lot of, you know, on TikTok, like stay till the end, or like, you won't believe the last one. It's because they're just desperately trying to get people to hang around just like a little bit longer.
The YouTube thumbnail of content and everything really, for better or worse, has fallen into that world.
I know. I think about this all the time. The algorithm of today is the like starting point for explaining like why any digital content is the way it is. There are so many people across digital media that are just so obsessively optimizing around what the algorithm rewards them or disincentivizes them to do, that that explains why the content is structured the way that it is. So if the algorithms change, that changes the whole content landscape. There's four or five algorithms in the United States that dictate how all content looks, essentially, across digital and social. When you see like these thumbnails and these things, people are trying to just like nail these algorithms. It's like the whole game.
Does that concern you?
There are pros and cons.
Walk me through the pros first. I feel more strongly about the cons.
This could be our next segment on Undisputed here. So I think it's good because the algorithms are really good at personalization and delivering an experience to your app or your phone or whatever that is super customized in a way that was never possible before. That can be good. It's really cool when you have like a really small niche interest, you get to really explore that and really be fulfilled by that. That's like a relatively new phenomenon that was like hard to do before YouTube 20 years ago. And that's opened up this whole content ecosystem and all of these little businesses and all these little organizations of people that sort of like live as barnacles on the side of the algorithm ship. It's fascinating. Like that's what I'm doing more now. It's so interesting. And I think people don't realize how much of that is out there. I'm sure billions and billions of dollars of value in these businesses are out there and hundreds of thousands of people who rely on them. The cons, obviously, like there's a lot of worry about misinformation and wind tunnels and those sorts of things for sure. And clickbait. And I think getting back to more directly talk about the incentivization structures, that is definitely a concern. Because guess what? Our media is in a capitalist society. These are businesses trying to make money. The tech platforms are trying to make money. The digital publishers are trying to make money. And so as long as that's true, there's going to be a race to attract eyeballs, which is how the whole thing works. If you don't have eyeballs, then you're not getting any viewership. And if you don't have viewership, you're not hitting ad impressions and generating revenue. There's really not like a scenario that I see how that can be avoided. It's like a hugely profitable enterprise.
On that point, I think it's interesting what you mentioned. And there's so much optimization. You want to have these viewership where people stick to the end. In the system of checks and balance, is there a balance where if you do have something that just ends up being clickbait, you get to the end and there's nothing there, you even have these kind of engagement holes where people then, it basically triggers you to write in the comments, which also increases in the algorithm. You've been behind the scenes in part of this. Is there balance going on? This is partially to make us feel better, that to offset some of the bad actors who really just try to take advantage of all those dynamics?
I can tell you at Snap, they take that stuff really seriously. Snap's philosophy on content is a lot different in many ways, or it has been in many ways, than a YouTube or an Instagram, in that a lot of the content is vetted and given permission to publish on the platform in advance, which is different. It's not as open, quote unquote, a platform as the others. They have a little bit more control over the publishers and how they, quote unquote, game the system. And like, you might say game the system, you might say optimizing for the algorithm, maybe two in the same thing.
Potato, potato. Yeah.
At Snap, if you like flagged an episode as being clickbait, they would take that seriously and like look into that. And it would certainly not help you in the algorithm and all of these different things. So I can't speak exactly how it works behind the scenes at YouTube or other platforms, but at Snap, they take that stuff really seriously. And they have like a team that is trying their best to make sure that the platform is really credible for their young audience to be like consuming safe and accurate content. And also for advertisers to know that they can spend money in a place that is safe for their brand.
When you think about the future, it's interesting where yesteryear was you come out into the media, maybe you get picked up by ABC or Fox, and you work your way through the system, but your talent that's part of that organization, now you have YouTube stars, you have Snap stars. Each platform builds their own stars, but they're users. They're not employees, but they are making the business money. And it feels like there's more and more connectivity between the actual companies themselves and those star creators. But do you think that's something that advances more in the future? Do you think it will kind of continue the way that it is, that the power law has these big players and they'll get preferential treatment? Anything unique that you see happening in that space? And I know that kind of plays into more of the work that you're doing now.
Yeah. The big long-term trend has been towards this flattening of the whole system, reducing the barrier to entry to like get in the game, so to speak. Like if you go back 50 years, there's three broadcast networks, and that's all you could do, especially in sports. There weren't really that many like sports jobs. Then ESPN comes along and it's like, oh, here's another option. Here's a little more real estate in terms of the amount of perspectives and voices that are out there. And then cable TV comes along and then YouTube comes along. And it's like, now we're in this place where like literally right now, the three of us could just create an account and start posting and we're in the game. We could do that right now if we want. I don't think that's changing. I don't see anything to suggest that that's really going to change. Of course, just like anything else, it's a power law where like there's going to be big winners and a relatively small amount of that. Like I think that's always the case in media. But like the sources from where those big winners come from is just so much different than it was. Even just like from my background, we talked a little bit about my background off the top. I went to UConn and then I got an internship at a local ESPN radio station affiliate. And then I got an internship at MLB Network. And I like spent 10 years learning how quote unquote journalism works, sports journalism, before I was sort of given a bigger platform versus now. Like there is a, I'll call him a kid that I'm working with now. He's 25. So for me, that's like kid-ish. But he signed onto YouTube when he was 9 and started making content. And he has been doing this for 14-ish years, 15, whatever years. You know, and I'm sure when he was 9, it wasn't like Peabody award-winning content or anything like that. But like his editorial sensibilities have just been completely crafted by this algorithmically distributed environment that he's lived in for his entire content career. It's just like a completely different way that we're like developing storytelling talent now in a way that like was not happening 20 years ago. Like YouTube is just about 20 years old. Just 20 years and that whole process is completely different now.
Can you take us into the room with him and you like having a discussion about something content related and the different ways in which you would approach it? As you just said, you came from a much more traditional background and he kind of just developed it through producing and getting feedback directly from these platforms. What are the things that you would hang on to say like these are the main markers of difference?
I wouldn't. I literally would not ever do that. I totally acknowledge his knowledge of YouTube in particular is so much greater than mine. I think you have to know what you don't know. A lot of this in our world where like everybody thinks, yeah, we'll just like take our stuff over to YouTube and like start a thing. But it's like, you're competing against guys like this kid, quote unquote kid, who's been doing this for 16 years and like spent his formative years just cranking away on the algorithm. Finding these people, finding really talented people like this is really crucial for any organization. If you can find some of these people to come in and help you, that's almost more important than the stuff that you decide to post in terms of growing an audience, growing revenue on these various platforms.
Another way of getting at kind of a similar thing is if you were tasked with giving a college room advice on how to break into media or content production, what would you say to them as kind of like, you know, 18-year-olds looking ahead?
Yeah, I would tell them to just start. You don't have to wait for anybody. You can just start an account, do some stuff. The cost to production now is super low. You can have an iPhone with like a little tripod. That's kind of all you need. A lot of content that really works is quote unquote lower quality, user-generated content. We can go down that whole rabbit hole if you want, but that stuff really works. So you don't need a studio. You don't need all of these other resources to at least start. So what I would tell an 18-year-old now is like, just start a TikTok account I've worked with another kid who does like man on the street style stuff on TikTok. He's got hundreds of thousands of followers there. He just started. He's still in college. He's just cranking away. And then you take that with you. You have all this experience. And it's just the most natural, organic, getting back to the top, the most organic kind of experience that you can't teach. You can't teach understanding what it's like to face the content grind that is a social media platform. So if you're a kid, just start. Just get in there. Make sure that you like it. Like, you may not like it and you want to do something else. Don't wait 5 years to get like a proper job. Like, just get in there and start cranking.
I know now you're trying to basically take the new generation, connect them into the investment world. What has that experience been like? Because I think the investor world is definitely in tune with what's going on, but maybe more from the platform level and less at the individual level. So what has that experience been like?
Been so interesting. There's so many different market forces at work here. There's a lot of creators out there that have been doing this for a very long time and are just like ready to move on. And there's a lot of investors and people out there that are looking to like move in and grow the space. I think there is an opportunity to get some of these people that have built these awesome followings and have them get together with an investor to allow them to take a step back and live their lives a little bit. And it's been very interesting. I will say, finding these creators, each creator is like its own little small business. So it's not like you're like, let me forward you to the partnerships person or like, you know, this sort of thing. It's like a guy or a kid and like his dad or his mom, her dad, her mom, or like however, it's very mom and pop. And so there's a lot of education to be done on the creator level about how all of that stuff works. And I think there's also a lot of education to be done on the investor side too. These are businesses. I work with one creator who's made $1 million a year for the last 3 years on YouTube. That's a business. I would never describe what he does as just like a YouTube channel. Like, that is a business. That's a multi-million dollar business with super low overhead that's crushing. These are businesses. And I think if the investment community thought of it more like that and they like approached this as I want to like partner with this business or acquire this business or however, it may like unlock a lot more interesting like collaborations.
When they do invest, is that capital basically letting the creator sleep better at night? Is it getting reinvested into higher production quality or staff? Is it generally going into one particular area?
It gives some of them the opportunity to step away and do something different. I'm sure you guys will want to be doing Colossus forever, of course. Inevitably, after 10 years of doing the same thing every day, you might feel like you want to do something different. This is an opportunity to sort of cash out, focus on like a new endeavor that's interesting to them. It also, depending on how these things get structured, it could be an opportunity to sort of like secure their future while still working on it and like hitting earnouts and these sorts of things. They're still invested in the process, but their financial like short side is like very much not in doubt anymore. I just think there's a lot of fatigue in some aspects of the creator community.
From the investment standpoint, in the case you just laid out, it would make me nervous. There's so much key man risk or key woman risk in these businesses where the audience is there for the creator. And if they're getting burnt out and wanting to do either less or not do it at all, like, what do you end up owning as an investor? You might have subscribers, but like, what are you doing with it?
When I'm talking about this, I should have clarified, I'm not talking about Mr. Beast. I'm not talking about channel that is named after the person. That is obviously like not the same conversation. Of course, you would need the creator to come along. You're essentially like acquiring the brand and the person and the personality. Like, imagine if Amazon partnered with Mr. Beast and then he wasn't part of it. That would make no sense, of course. But there are loads of these other channels where it's kind of contrary to maybe like some of the stuff we've been talking about here. Personality agnostic. These people are just super talented behind the camera storytellers. Think about a channel that is using B-roll with narration, and they're just super good at picking the right topics and like cranking on the algorithm and growing their audience. That's the kind of thing that I'm looking at. There's an opportunity for a bigger guy to come in and bring that property like in-house and then use their size and their scale to like monetize that better than the quote unquote kid and his dad can. And so that's where I think it makes a lot of sense. You're right. If the channel is built completely around the personality, it's a totally different situation.
Awesome. Well, Mike, this has been a fun career arc, but also ties into a lot of the really interesting themes in media. So appreciate you sharing the knowledge, bringing us behind the scenes, making us feel a little bit better about the algorithm. All of those things have been excellent. So thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
I'd need to give Mike a special shout out for bringing energy to the podcast. This is a major thing that I feel like should be said more often. But when you bring that type of energy, it's a better conversation for the people on the other side of it. And it's majorly beneficial to the audience. And nobody's willing to say that, but I think there's a lot of underlying psychological stuff that just having good, positive energy brings. So just right off the bat, I want to say that.
Yeah, said in a very low energy voice, which I appreciate as well.
It's a really low energy. That was not low energy.
Oh, just kidding. It's funny because when I first joined this business and I was talking to you a lot about people and content and a podcast that we were doing, you would often talk about energy and energy signals. And like, it wasn't something that I had previously thought too much about, but I think you're spot on. Energy is infectious, but like passion. If someone's like really hyped up about something, I could probably listen to them talk about whatever it is, as long as they kind of have energy for it. And the converse is also true. If someone's genuinely passionate about something, but they just have like a very monotone, low energy voice, that is tough. So yeah, Mike did a great job. And for those who weren't in the recording, which is most of you, Matt and Mike spent about 10 minutes before the recording talking about maps. Mike has a lovely map behind him. So maybe that was the source of the energy.
I'm a big map guy, which is a discussion for another day. But yes, it was the leading start to a very good conversation. And I took some pleasure from looking at his maps. And he was a man that appreciates maps as well. So sorry you felt left out of that.
No, it's fine. Every day is a learning day. And this was a double learning day for me because as a Brit, we don't have Undisputed over here or many of the other things that we talked about. We do have Snapchat. So that was where I really found my zone.
Did you? Did you really find it?
We'll leave that up to other people to decide. But my research on Undisputed led me to a few YouTube videos in their channel where I was in an intense debate on whether Bronny should stay in college or should go into the NBA draft. And this was middle of last week or beginning of last week. So I was invested at that point. And then when I saw the news come out later in the week, I was like, hey, I've been primed for this moment. I would have had no opinion on the saga had I not watched that clip.
It's kind of amazing to me that you don't have context for who Skip Bayless is, because he is probably the most polarizing person in sports media. Now, you also aren't too familiar with Pat McAfee, Stephen A. Smith. Those would be the others in that category. But coming to it with fresh eyes, there's some benefits to that. It is just a wild, wild show. I think it drives so many people crazy because of some of the takes, but there's a lot to learn. It goes back to the very first episode, or maybe second episode with Spike. I just think there's so many things you can learn from sports media that can be applied. And obviously, most of what you learn from is the extreme versions. But if you just pull out some things from those extreme versions, the chemistry, the strong opinions, talking about things you actually care about, which brings energy. All of those things are actually really valuable. And it's like some of it can feel just maybe more high level, but I actually just agree more and more with all of those opinions in terms of how you approach content as time goes on.
Yeah. And the personalities, whether you like them or not, that's kind of part of the magic anyway. But it also takes, and you made the point in the podcast, like it takes a special type of person who can show up 5 days a week, starting at 4 a.m. and produce interesting content, regardless of which side of the fence you sit on. And so like that should never be underplayed. So much of this stuff always comes back to like things that you would do with your buddies over a beer on a Friday evening. Like that generally makes really good sports content. And, you know, that's morphed into other zones that Mike talked about too. But that doesn't mean that you can do it well. There are some famous groups who said, like, oh, we just moved our WhatsApp chat into a podcast or whatever it might be. But for most people, that won't work because you don't have the energy or you can't do it every single day. You might be able to do it once a month when something really lights you up. But to be able to talk across disciplines and issues and people in an interesting manner is genuinely impressive.
Yes. I thought his point on Shannon Sharp, another person that you aren't familiar with, but was a very good NFL football player who went into the traditional media world after the fact. Traditional pregame show, you're kind of stuck in between all these people. I'm not going to retell exactly the story that he told, but I thought it was a really good example of just how the entire playing field has changed. post-career and kind of for everyone. Like, I think that translates from sports into some other things as well. It used to be the higher profile players would get the first opportunities to do some of this stuff, but you were still kind of pigeonholed into a box. And the personalities might emerge, but you kind of had to be picking and choosing right in terms of the opportunities that you were taking. And if you went into those big behemoths like ESPN, it wasn't necessarily going to showcase what you can do well. And now you have all of these other avenues. And he is a really good example. Somebody, actually Tyler, that we both know well, recommended a podcast that he did with Cat Williams. But it was an unexpected thing that he recommended. Then I listened to the show. I'm like, this is absolutely wild. Just kind of hilarious in a lot of different ways. And yeah, I think it's just a really good point. And I just kind of look at those types and say, what could be taken away just in terms of what's happened and the outcome here? Because I don't think 20 years ago, he would have had anywhere near the career that he's about to have or is having right now in the media landscape.
Yeah, I'll be honest, this might get me canceled, but when I first came across the name, I wondered whether it was a woman, whether there was like a man-woman act on Undisputed.
Oh, Shannon.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's fair. But you guys have like footballers named Ashley too, so it works both ways.
I was neither for nor against it. It was just a factual statement.
Yep. Club Shay Shay should have been the telltale sign. That's the...
Yeah, well, I don't want to spell that because I always get Chi-Town wrong. We're learning slowly. I would say if people are interested in the end of the discussion we had on kind of investing in creators, YouTube or otherwise, we did a business breakdown on Spotter, which is kind of becoming one of the preeminent like financing firms of creators. On YouTube specifically, they worked with MrBeast and various other firms. It's a very interesting discussion on how you can put dollars behind these creators. And now that's slightly different. The creator isn't coming to them looking to move on to something else. It's more that they are looking for growth. And I think Spotter generally buys the library of catalog that they have done, gives them the capital to then invest in growing or more professionalizing their operation. So if that lit something underneath you, I would suggest going to listen to that because it was an interesting discussion.
Yes, a very finance forward approach, back catalog purchases, which then therefore finance future content creation. Interesting episode for sure.
Yeah, TBD on how it all plays out, but worth listening to if you're interested in that stuff.
Definitely. Yes. The other thing, I just thought it was interesting. I had this image of FS1 that he was around for the launch and some of the interesting things that came out of that, because I do think it shaped a lot of the media landscape. I might be over attributing some of it to FS1. That's how I feel, certainly. And then it was just interesting to hear him say, yeah, but launching when ESPN was at the peak of its powers was not all that great. And it's just a great counter. So many of the good, interesting things can happen from businesses that are smaller and can't necessarily compete with the big behemoths. They end up ultimately not winning, but you could take the lessons away from them. So it's just interesting to think about, like, today, where is that happening? And can you borrow some of the ideas that are being tested elsewhere and bring them in?
Totally. Yeah, I don't have much context for that either, but sure other people might do. The last thing I'll say is I found the career trajectory so interesting. He was talking about he's had this traditional media upbringing and he's now working with people, and his advice to a 16, 17 year old would be just start doing stuff on whatever platform takes your interest. That has changed in 10 years. I have to imagine that in the next 10 years, it's going to be a different answer as well, with all these new tools proliferating on kind of a daily basis. It's just wild to see how quickly that's changed. And even if you think about our journey into media, both behind a mic and also behind a business, you couldn't have predicted that 10 years ago either. There is no room for predictions here because I think it's just all up in the air. But so much of it comes back to just kind of doing what humans are naturally interested in, like talking to friends and then publishing that stuff and hoping that you have a personality or aligning with personalities that are really good at it. It will be a fun journey to see where it goes.
Yeah. The point on talking to people who have been producing on YouTube for 10 plus years, I've had some experience with people like that. They will blow your mind. Honestly, blow your mind.
In what way?
The grip that they have on the YouTube system and how quickly it can change, what changes you have to make for that, adjusting your content for that. Now, it is a little bit of like a feedback loop where they're constantly chasing what is changing, but that underplays it. It's not like the algorithm is this obvious thing. And you need to make your content good enough such that it gets picked up on that. So one needs to marry the other. But I can just remember having this conversation with somebody who's been doing it for years and years and years. And he was throwing these ideas at me just in terms of having a live feed. And once you have people coming and watching that live feed, it's constantly streaming. But you could be basically running existing content through a 24-hour feed. And if people are watching, that's going to get you picked up elsewhere. It's going to direct things into this and that. And it's like, that was just like one small piece of it. But all these other things, there was like no talk of thumbnails, which are obviously what gets most of the attention, just a million little details. And you could understand if you come from a traditional background of film or TV or something else, and then you go into this landscape and you're like, well, just make great content. And you kind of like don't have the feel for that ecosystem. It's just like a completely different playing field. It's almost like you're a great basketball player and you show up and you're playing football. It's just completely different. Yes, you still need to be athletic. Yes, you still need to be able to run fast and jump high and do all this. But the rules are totally different and one does not translate to the other. So when he was talking about that, I appreciated his humility or humbleness about what he would suggest to them. And it just resonated just from my own personal experience.
It's funny you say that. It made me think of something that Emily, our previous guest, wrote in a newsletter this week about, and I forget which female pop star it was, but she on Instagram turned her stories into close friends, but she put her whole like 9 million followers as a close friend. And so when she put a story and it came up with kind of the green ring rather than the traditional ring around it, everyone thought, oh my goodness, like how does she know that I'm such a good friend of her? She's never met me before. Obviously, everyone was a close friend, but then I think that saw a huge uplift in her followers. That's such a smart
Billie Eilish
move.
Was it Billie Eilish?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Added about 7 million.
Yeah, which is insane. She just understands the platform so well. Like those small little things, that opportunity's been and gone probably once you've done it once. However, if you're kind of at the bleeding edge of these things, like many of these people who start when they're 9 on Roblox, whatever it is, yeah, it can be impressive, the dials they find.
Not like us at the lagging edge.
Yeah. Yeah, we're very much at the tail end.
Awesome. That was fun. Always good to go back into the world of sports. And again, Mike was enjoyable. Interesting to see what he's up to now. And to your point, how his career's evolved along with the industry. Kind of have people that really like mirror the industry changes, and Mike falls into that category. So, fun conversation.
Definitely. He's our barometer. See you next time.
Yes. See you next week.